This week on Art on the Air features two dynamic authors, novelists, poets, who are also professors at Indiana University Northwest, William Allegrazia and Garen Seichel, both sharing their literary journey and recent works. Our spotlight is on Chesterton Art Center's program director, Jillian Bridgman, sharing about their classes, summer art camps, and activities of the teen art group.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And I'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight. She's the program director, which means like education and all the other things for the Chesterton Art Center. She's going to tell us about things that are upcoming that you may be interested in. Welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight, Jillian Bridgman.
Aloha, Jillian. Thank you for having me.
Well, you have lots of exciting things coming up, especially early summer and some things beyond. So we're going to turn it over to you and just tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. As was said, I am the program director over at the Chesterton Art Center. And what I wanted to talk about today is our exciting summer camp lineup. So we have six sessions of summer art camp that are going to be offered this summer, and each one is going to follow kind of its own unique theme. So there's lots of variety and different topics that hopefully will interest different kids and different styles of art making. So we have everything from clay. There's going to be a camp all about science fiction. There's a camp specifically all about using your imagination and kind of inventing your own worlds. There's even a camp focused on portraiture, ones about texture and animals. So we have lots of different themes that are going to be captured each week. And each camp is typically offered to two age groups. We try to break it into ages 5 to 8 in our morning time slot, which runs from 8:30 to 11. And then ages 8+ runs in the afternoon from 12 to 2:30. The only exception to that is our clay camp. The age is just a little bit older on that one since they are going to be working on the wheel. So that one's ages 9 to 12 and then 12+ in the afternoon. The big factor about that as well is tuition ranges between 100 and 140 per session. But we do have scholarships available to all students. Applications are up on our website on chestertonart.org/scholarships. And you can send those applications directly to me at my email, which is programs@chestertonart.org.
You have other things going on, too, with the summer camps. And you might go ahead and go over some of the dates they run. But you've expanded some of the education possibilities, not only for kids, but all around. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So on the topic of dates for camps, they're going to be running through the months of June and July. We have the first four sessions happening in June, starting as early as June 6th. And then we have two more sessions that follow that up in July. In terms of other expansion beyond kind of our youth programming, we are expanding our teen arts group, which is a group of kind of high school age students where we bring them together and kind of give them professional arts experiences. And specifically this summer for them, we're doing a partnership with the Upsidaisi Market and creating a public art project that's going to take place at the market. It's going to be a great project. I'll keep it a little bit of a surprise so people that visit the market could kind of come and see. But it is something collaborative where visitors of the market are going to be able to engage with that project.
Can you disclose what kind of materials will be used?
Yeah, so it's going to actually be a mixture of materials. We're going to play on the concept of the market itself, which is this idea of upcycled, recycled, vintage style, treasures and things like that. So we're going to specifically be creating almost a large scale sculpture that people are then going to add different fabrics, weavings, all different types of materials that we can kind of upcycle into this large scale sculpture.
Then does it get displayed at the Chesterton Art Center? Will it be up every market?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we're just going to be at the market for 3 Sundays in June. So our goal is to just kind of have it exist during that time in the market. And then we haven't totally decided where it's going to live beyond that, but we're really hoping to incorporate it into kind of future events that are happening with the center. So it's kind of a community piece that's built through the market, and then we hopefully can transform it and bring it along for other things that happen with us.
Tell us about the Teen Arms Group. Who can join it? How do they join? And what else do they do? I think they've had several exhibits like at Red Cup. Just tell us a little bit about it.
Absolutely. So Teen Arts Group, we kind of nickname it TAG. So TAG is a group specifically dedicated to upper middle schoolers as well as high schoolers that are just interested in greater arts experiences. And we basically try to give that to them. It's a totally free program. We really are a small commitment. It's just once a month in most cases. And things that we've done in the past, we did do an exhibit over at Red Cup. We are going to visit the MCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago this summer to go see a great show that's going to be on display. In the case of Upsidaisi Market, we're doing a public art project. And then we also do things like portfolio reviews. We've had artists come in and talk about their work that's on display here at the center and beyond. We're planning a couple different local college visits to the art departments. So we're really just trying to broaden students in the area's understanding of kind of what art opportunities exist around here, and also bringing those teenagers together to meet each other and kind of build their own community of different young artists and aspiring artists in our area.
So will that be from 13 to 19, or is there a different age range that you're focusing on?
Yeah, I would say that's a great kind of estimate. We don't put necessarily a number on it. It's really based on kind of the interest that comes through. I would say the majority fall right into that range, with our youngest being an eighth grader. And then we have students that are taking like a gap year right before college. So it kind of goes right in between there. But the majority are kind of your sophomore, junior age that are ready to kind of start thinking next steps.
Recently, you had a renovation in one or both of the workspaces there, the studios in there. So tell us a little bit about some of the things that happened that changed.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're hoping to kind of get our classrooms configured for this idea of growth that we're hoping for all together with programs at the center. Our lower classroom received a whole new paint job. We're building a whole new ceramics area to kind of build up that side of the program, and really just doing kind of a general clean out and organization of both rooms so that we can kind of allow for this expansion of our programs, both for adults and for youth.
What programs have you talked about implementing that you haven't so far but are visioning to do?
Yeah, so some of the new stuff coming up, we have some different writing classes that are going to be offered. We're trying to get a wider range of mixed media and painting classes offered on the calendar. We're also expanding the ceramics program that has already existed, but we're trying to make it a little bit more robust. And then we're hoping to bring in some new youth programs. We've played a little bit with kind of comics and maybe the idea of animation and even videography. So we have lots of exciting things that we're hoping to kind of start bringing into the center gradually.
Very good. Well, this is the summer project. TAG's going to be doing their partnering with Upsidaisi Market, and you have the entire summer arts camp. You can find out that at chestertonart.org, if I'm correct. And that's Jillian Bridgman, who is the program director for the Chesterton Arts Center. Jillian, thank you so much for being on Art on the Air Spotlight.
Yes, thank you guys so much.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
we would like to welcome William Allegrezza and Garen Seichel, both authors, collaborators, and longtime friends to Art on the Air. Bill teaches at Indiana University Northwest and is editor of Maria Books and Moss Trill, a poetry blog zine. He has published 18 books. The books include poetry, translations, and scholarly works. He's also a father, avid hiker, bass player, and typewriter enthusiast. Garen grew up in southeastern Illinois and has lived in various places around the country, with the last several decades in Chicago. His work, particularly his series of Illinois poems, explores violence, displacement, and changing ecologies across the state and throughout the 20th century. Garen teaches at Indiana University Northwest. His book reviews regularly appear with TypeScript, Rain Taxi, and the Chicago Review of Books. Rex is Garen's first novel. Thank you both for joining Larry and I on Art on the Air. Aloha to you.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Larry, Esther.
Thanks so much. It's a joy to be with you.
Welcome, yes. Gentlemen. Well, we would like to always find your origin story. And what that means is, and like I always like to say, how you got from where you were to where you are now. So, Bill, we'll start with you. Tell us about yourself.
All right. Since you called it an origin story, I feel like it should be epic and heroic, but it's I don't know that it fits that.
It just might be.
I grew up in Mississippi. Oh, yeah. So I grew up in Mississippi, which I kind of assume, you know, as a Southern state is a fiction state. So coming out of Mississippi as a poet is kind of rare. I got to say, so I came to poetry, and this is origin story for poetry, from music. So I'm a bass player. I was playing in a bunch of bands in high school and became a lead singer. And if you're curious, I'm a horrible singer, but it was a punk rock band. So I guess it doesn't matter, you know, a ton. And I just got more interested in the lyrics that I was writing than the music. And I kept writing lyrics. And next thing you know, that was my main interest. As it was, I actually went off to college to become a chemist, but would spend all night reading. So I thought, you know, I just can't do this. I gotta switch over and, you know, became a poet and wrote for years before I actually ever published anything. And then, you know, once I did, I just kept going from there.
Well, tell us a little bit about like growing up a little bit. Was writing anything part of your world then? Or was that just like you described a discovery thing later in life?
So I didn't write very much when I was a kid. My mother was an English teacher, and I'm sure that filtered into things. She was always assigning us books in the summer as kids. So we were thinking, well, I already have a school assigned book, you know, and you're giving me a couple more books to read here in the summer. But I was a big reader. I loved mysteries and things like that. But I didn't write. I didn't write much at all. And actually, she gave me a journal when I was 9. And I still have it. And I look back at the entries and they're like 2 sentences long. So like I woke up and ate some pizza. And that was the extent of my writing at that period. So it wasn't until later. And then honestly, I feel like when I went off to college, I felt like a little bit of a Mississippi country boy and I went to Dallas and I just flew into the city and reading, and I spent all night. I mean, I would spend all night long reading. I even got a summer job for General Motors where they would let me be a security guard and I would read for 8 hours straight, and I would look up and say, all right, hello. And then I would just keep reading. So I think I kind of trained myself later on, not early.
You mentioned your mother gave you a journal. Have you given your children journals, and do they write more than the sentence or so?
My kids are not interested in journals. I don't know what's up. They're huge readers. I'm kind of she's just turned 11. My 11-year-old reads an amazing amount a week. She'll go through like 900 pages a week. And I think, kid, that's incredible. I can't imagine doing that when I was that age, but they don't write that much. And, you know, maybe they will later on. And I don't even talk about writing that much with them, to be honest. So I figured they have to figure out what's good for them and what works for them. And my youngest is definitely more on the visual art side. So it's kind of fun to see that happen in itself.
Yeah. So much of that comes from the English teachers that you're involved with, I think, almost more than your parents, unless your friend's journal. It's not anything that I really did either. So Garen, what about you? Where did you grow up, and what was your early life like?
I grew up in Southern Illinois, Southeastern Illinois, about the 3.5 hours south of Chicago. We were kind of directly in between Memphis and Chicago. So it was always kind of the question of whether we were South or North in some ways. We would, you know, sometimes go to Memphis or Mississippi for trips, and sometimes we'd come north to Chicago. So it's kind of a strange world of being in between those two places. So
I know you know, I read that you wrote, I've always felt on the edge of some South, which was just like so evocative to me, because I did some growing up in the South as well, but it wasn't necessarily considered South, even though it was really, really South. So
yeah, that section of Illinois is so far down, right? You don't have to drive very far to find your way into Tennessee, and then, you know, from there to Mississippi. But as Bill reminds me over and over again, I am not a Southern writer because I am from Illinois. So that perspective is one that's informed me. My family were both from Springfield, Illinois originally. And they grew up there. And my dad went to medical school at the Illinois College of Medicine in Chicago. So, you know, spent the first few years of my life there. And we ended up back in Illinois, in Southeastern Illinois. And he practiced there as a family doctor throughout his career. I went to school in Miami, did my graduate work at Yale, and then found my way back to Illinois and pastored a couple of churches there in the southeastern part of the state. And then decided to go back to grad school and moved to Chicago. And I've been here now for the last 25 years.
So did you show an aptitude for writing in elementary, you know, or grade school or high school, any of those early years?
I really enjoyed writing. I tried a couple of novels that were always about yesterday, kind of things that I destroyed the next day. I read a lot of history when I was growing up. I was just enamored with history and just read tons of history. So that's really informed me in terms of my approach to writing and the subject that I like to, subjects I like to delve into.
You know, before we move on to some of your writing, I'm just curious how, and I'll ask this of both of you, how you both ended up at IUN and some of the things that you do there. I think, Garen, you're involved with the Writing Center, but tell us a little about that, and then we'll also ask Bill about IUN.
Yeah, I did my grad work at UIC in the city, and so I was teaching there at the point when Bill and I developed a friendship, and we wrote a lot together. We did a trip down to down to Jackson, his home place, at one point, just about a year and a half, I think, maybe after Katrina, Hurricane Katrina. And so we did a journey down, and we were working on this long poem called Aquinas and the Mississippi together at that point. So when IUN was looking for someone to teach fiction, Bill gave me a call, and it was a great joy to get to work with him more directly. Writing at IUN has been a lot of fun. I teach a fall fiction course on regional writers. So we look at Midwestern and Great Lakes writers, because I always want to argue that Northwest Indiana is not really Midwest. It's more Great Lakes in its orientation and culture. So we read a lot of Northern writers. And then I teach a horror writing class in the spring. So all students who want to write about blood gravitate into those classrooms. So it's a lot of fun.
And Bill, what brought you to IUN?
Yeah, so I think my journey to IUN is really my journey to the Midwest. When I was in grad school finishing my PhD at Louisiana State, I wanted to move. So I booked a ticket to Chicago, got a hotel for 3 days, and then came up and looked for an apartment, trying to find something. And I sent an email to IUN. This was a long time ago. And the head of the department called me and said, "You are the first person ever to email the department, and you're looking for a job. We just so happen to have something in world literature," which is my kind of area. And so I came in and started working part-time. And I can tell you my ignorance, because I had no idea. I'm like, Indiana's close to Chicago? How does that even happen? And I remember my first group of students saying, you know, "I'm from Maryville and Schererville." I'm like, who would name these towns like that right next to each other? But, you know, I've been at IUN so long that I've kind of developed a love for the region. My first 10 years, I lived in Chicago. Then I moved down into Indiana after that. And, you know, I teach all kinds of students and all different levels. And it's just a blast. I really love my students here.
Yeah. As a side story, when I was working for the Center of Visual Performing Arts in the 90s and getting actors to come out from Chicago, and they said, "Now, do I need a hotel room? I says, we're closer to downtown than the then Candlelight Theater. So there is a perception when you cross that state boundary that you're out in a barn somewhere. So
yeah, there is for sure.
So tell us a little bit about your some of your writing. I guess we'll go back to Garen first, so we can flip-flop here. Tell us about some of the subject matter that you do. And I know Esther's going to prompt you on some of the things we're going to actually read on the show. So,
yeah, the most recent thing is the novel Rex, which is a novel written in 50 chapters, one for each state. It's about a guy who assumes his dead father's identity and practices medicine. And the kind of the rub of the story is that it's happening in a time of kind of disintegrating national unity in politics, and there's kind of violence afoot throughout the country. And he comes to believe that one of his patients may be involved in a conspiracy. And so the question becomes, does he out his patient, or does he kind of keep his, keep his confidence in the end? And if he gets out the patient, then he has to give up his own identity, his own kind of
secret.
Yeah, for sure. And so that was kind of a piece I've worked on for a few years now. And the 50 chapters thing just seemed to give it a way of doing it when I would find a little bit of time to write.
So do the 50 chapters or the states, do they happen at the same time? Or because I really looked forward to each state and how you were going to tie the narrative into that title. I mean, I was just like, oh, I couldn't wait to get to the next one too. You know, once I figured out that it was each state was different and you weren't going like, here I'm in Mississippi and then I'll go here and then I'll go back to Mississippi. Once I realized that each state was unique.
Yeah, the premise is the one of his patients uncovers the pattern where there's an act of violence in each state day by day. And so the question becomes, when will my state be next? And that's kind of a prevailing tension throughout the book. The ordering of the states was pretty much just, I had written a lot of the pieces and then I just kind of taped them up on the wall and figured out, how they best fit together in the end. Cause there's several plot lines that work in and out of different patients' lives. And the challenges that they're facing.
So that brings up a question for both of you, actually. So do you have pretty standard writing practices? And I'm going to like mine is so varied. Sometimes things come out in one fell swoop and there's not much change that needs to happen. But other times it might happen over days, weeks, months, a year that I write down bits here, bits there, and then I piece them all together, sort of like your board where you did it. Do you have a standard way that you work or is it similar to that situation?
Bill, tell us your process first.
Well, sure. So I think it depends on the project. As Esther mentioned, I've done 18 books, but I've written, probably 26 at this point. I think it's really different. So my first couple of books were fairly experimental with language play, and they had a kind of similar theme. They wanted to be political and push the reader outside of language to the limits of what language could do. And I've grown much more narrative over time. Like some of those original books, the book pushed me. So one book, a Finnish Press asked me to do a 250 page book. And I'm like, okay, I only have, 60 days of this, but I'm like, okay, I'm going to do 5 poems a day for 50 days and then I'm done. I'm not going to edit it. I'm just going to send it to them. And, that was the process. That was great. And now I look back at that book and I'm like, oh, there were some brilliant pieces, but there's also a lot of stuff I wish I could cut because the process was just there. So I think it really depends on what I'm doing. And lately, I'm working on 3 books right now and they're it's a very different process. One of them is kind of like put it up on the wall, see how it works out. And one of them is basically a hiking poetry book, which is something I never thought I would do. But another poet was like, you write all the time when you're at campsites because I do a lot of camping. And he's like, why don't you put it together as a book? So I'm like, okay, I will. But it's very narrative and it's based on places. And so I really just sit with those. So I think it really depends on the project more than anything else for me.
Hey, I work a lot between genres. So, I'll be working on a fiction project and then put it aside. And, sometimes shorter poems distract me, sometimes longer poems, kind of catch my attention. I write do some screenwriting as well. So when one project seems to hit a wall, you know, I feel like I can shift pretty easily to a different project, and it kind of generates some new stuff for the place where the writing was kind of falling into the doldrums.
You know, I found Rex to be extremely poetic, and I had to at times remind myself that I was reading a novel and not just a very long poem. The language is very beautiful, and I'm really enjoying it. Thanks. So I imagine being, so I think, what did I read that you're, and you tell me actually something about you are a poet who is there was some phrase that you used, you're really a novelist who's a poet, or a poet who is a novelist. I can't remember, but
I say both of them at different times, depending on who I'm with at the time.
Well, I found the book to be extremely poetic.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel like the density of the language, I have to remind myself over and over again to be a good editor, because I sometimes fall in love with a turn of phrase so much that, but I really tried to work against that in Rex and try to maintain a sense of pushing the narrative forward, as opposed to kind of delving deeper and deeper into character through language only.
Do you have an excerpt that you would like to read from Rex?
Yeah, sure. I can do that. I was going to read a passage that some listeners might recognize as well. It's kind of a piece that works off of a short story by William Carlos Williams called The Use of Force, where Williams is trying to, as a physician, is trying to care for a child who is ill and is struggling with that. And so this is from the Kentucky chapter, from Rex. Rex has been called to a home out in the country to take care of a sick child. "Thanks for coming all the way out here," the mother said, opening the door. The kid stunk of sweat and sickness. Her body grew more rigid as I approached. It was the same girl Williams had treated. I didn't recognize her from the office. The eyes were just a few days older, perhaps, but definitely a girl now. And if it was the same girl, she'd learn how to hold still. The smiling mother, still no help. Maybe she smiled from embarrassment and ignorance and the fact that she let things get this far. Maybe she smiled because she needed a cigarette. My boyfriend thought she'd get over it soon enough. "You were wise to call me," I said. "There's some nasty stuff going around." I lifted the child's t-shirt and back. Her skin was hot. "Now, honey, the stethoscope is going to be a little cold," I said, as I applied it halfway up her shoulder blade. "Now just breathe in and out for me." The girl's shriek must have reached the town. Not long before, I would have flinched, but now I'd grown used to my fingers against skin. I pressed more of my warm hand against the girl's back, reminding myself that family practice was not my specialty. I did it only out of praxis. I'd been trained to shrink heads. I'm not a real doctor. I'm a psychiatrist, I told people, and they laughed. "But you'd come to town and your waiting room was full with a terminally chronic, all willing to test your country doctor resolve and patience." I looked over at the mother. Maybe I knew her from just such an encounter. "I kept her home from school yesterday," her mother straightened her shirt, tried a diagonal smile that hit her bad teeth, "but she doesn't seem to have gotten any better." I was still too clumsy with the otoscope poking its worn out light at the girl's ears. The child endured me silently, her muscles tightening against my fingers. I felt along her neck, slightly swollen, but with a distinct purplish tint. She glared, and I expected her to take a swipe at me with her sharp, kitty nails. "Let's take a look at your sore throat." She opened her mouth willingly, but turned back and forth against my feeble penline. The ears were slightly red, but I couldn't see a thing inside her throat. I swabbed a culture and rubbed it against the sticky specimen dish. "How long has she been running a fever?" "She's felt warm to me for maybe a week now. We don't have a thermometer." "Well, we ought to get her on some antibiotics. Where do you get your medicine?" I took out the script pad, which had continued to yell. I had to tear off the top one where Moore had played a couple games of tic-tac-toe on it. The mother looked hesitant. "I have to call," she said. "Don't worry, I'll call the office. My nurse will take care of it. I left my phone at the office. Can I use yours?" I looked around the house. The TV blared with cartoons. "We don't have one," she said. Again, that smile. I called from the neighbors. "Well, I'll take care of it when I get back to town. Maybe call your boyfriend at work and have him pick up the medicine." But the mother had tuned me out, her attention back on the girl. gone rigid again. The girl tucked the edge of her thumb in her mouth. As I turned to the door, I stopped. By the way, where do you eat your eggs? Our neighbor, Mr. Skaggs, brings them by. Maybe keep her off eggs for a few days. Have you and your boyfriend been well? We're okay, she said, breaking down into a series of high nicotine coughs. She smiled, wiping her hand on her jeans. I'll go in there.
You know, that image, and you mentioned it several times throughout the novel, that visual image of like that, the eggs, the snake, like leathery sort of eggs, just really was reminiscent of Angel Heart to me, with the devil and the egg, and how you're expecting, you know, the egg is like a hope and luck and wealth and sometimes linked to the universe, and to have, you know, this image of the egg, you know, how you enter the egg being maybe the link to what's going on. It was really, it's very powerful.
Thank you. Skaggs is kind of an infernal figure like that in some ways, right? He's he kind of has a his history is so kind of hidden, and he withholds so much of it that you really don't know where he's from.
He withholds, but then he prods and he like, yeah, it's really.
You're listening to Art on the Air with William Allegrezza and Garen Cycle on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Well, Bill, we'd like to hear something that you've written, either several passages or everything, and share that with our audience.
Sure. I just say that was great, Garen. I really enjoyed hearing you read. It's something seems great about hearing you read it with a cold too, like you're doing this in characters. I'll read just a couple of poems. This one, actually, I thought about this one because of Esther's question, how do I come up with stuff? One thing I do as a writer is I write all the time. I just feel like I can't help it. I'm actually sitting in my basement right now, and the beams above me are full of Sharpie, because I will just stand up and start writing. And, you know, guaranteeing my office at work, anybody who comes by IUN can see this, but there's usually writing on my walls as well. So I had an apartment about 16, 17 years ago, and I had one room of it where I would just literally write all over the walls, and I would paint over it and write again. And I didn't save any of it except for this one piece. Is the only thing I ever copied down from that. And I kind of think of writing as temporary as well. So I play off this, but this comes from that just scribble basically on a wall. It's called A Question. And I've always hated the fact that I think this poem is as relevant now as it was when I wrote it, because it's got a little bit of political edge. There is one thing in it that is from Old English, because I like to play with languages a little bit. It just means in days of old. That's all it is. So, a question. Why are the guns always pointed towards Korea? And why are you always here reading over my shoulder, disbelieving that I can see shadow turn into shadow and flowers and fields that I had never seen, or swifts over vineyards that might never have existed or have been gone for thousands of years, or that in Yirdaga makes as much sense as anything I could say just now, as if words themselves can explain why the silence continues to echo in rooms that I create with time and language, rooms that I cannot inhabit except through doing as you are doing just now. I know that's just the only piece I decided to keep off the walls. The rest of it I just got rid of, and I kind of like the process of getting rid of things. I know I've told Garen this, but I had a series going for a couple of years. I like typewriters, but I would type up a poem, I would put the name of a famous poet on it, but then I would look up an address for somebody else with that name, and I would slip in the piece of paper and send it to them, but I wouldn't keep records of it. And I think that was just a way. Yeah.
What a nice surprise.
Yeah. I never got a response. I kind of thought somebody would say, okay, I respond back, but I never got a response.
So where was the apartment that you, and how, you said it was 17 years ago?
Yeah, that was in Chicago. I lived in Chicago. Hyde Park, right across the street from the university for a while. So I had a nice study that looked out on the people in the street, which I used for inspiration, but then the back room I just used to write. So that changed when I had kids, and they kind of needed that room at that point. So I couldn't just keep writing over it. I'll read one more quick piece, and then we can go wherever you guys want to. This one is one people often ask me to read, and it doesn't have a name, although I've given it a name several times. So I always think it's fun because sometimes high schools will write me and say, what does this name mean? I think, well, actually, it's not even the real name. I just had to give it that name for a publication sometimes. But it's occasionally called It Aches Greece, which I think has nothing to do with the poem. But it's fun to see how people interpret it. So this one. The journey begins when you leave stormy waters and give up hold of the shore. I have no longing to be trapped under clouds and storm, still divided, waiting for something to clutch as the helm goes wild and lightning flashes on peaks turned white. In trusting the drift, one must be prepared for destruction at sea.
Beautiful. One question I'd like to ask both of you, and we've had different reactions from different artists and writers and musicians we've had in the air. How has COVID impacted you during the pandemic? You know, there was a big shutdown. You were off campus from the university, but both, like, in your work, did it end up being a creative period, or did you kind of shut down? Garen, we'll go with you first.
I mean, I guess as an artist, Rex came out right on the tail end of COVID, of the isolation kind of period. So the biggest impact was not being able to get out with the book and do some readings when it first came out. So I'm trying to catch up and do some of that kind of stuff now. But it really profoundly affected me as a teacher, because I really love to work with students and kind of feed off interaction with them and energy, their energies, and really missed the classroom. And it's been a real joy to kind of get back and working with fiction students, you know, one-to-one on campus again.
Did you keep up with, did you have online classes or online, sessions with the students?
Yeah, we did. We did online classes, which, you know, some students really responded well to it. So you could work one-on-one with them, you know, in conversations on Zoom. But a lot of times students were just so exhausted by the whole process and the anxieties of the time that it was hard to, you know, to find the energy for them sometimes, I think, to continue with it.
I know for me, it was sort of because I was teaching art. And so once we got the hang of the students putting the art up to the camera so that I could see it, it really worked. It really worked well. So mm-hmm. How about you, Bill?
Yeah, I'm it's a little similar. I think when the pandemic hit, I just kind of shut down creatively for at least a year and a half. I kept writing. I look back at the writing I did and I'm not that happy about it. I did a couple of pieces that I was kind of excited about it, but only because people asked me. They were like, you know, we're putting together a COVID issue for this magazine. Can you do it? And then I sat down and I literally thought about the experience and wrote them. And I like that. But the rest of the time, I feel like along with Garen as a teacher, I did not like doing, well, you know, we did a lot of Zoom classes and I just didn't enjoy that. The discussions weren't that good. And so I feel like it's been very good coming out of it a little bit. You know, I don't want to say we're over it, but, you know, it's been very good to get out and connect with the community. The one thing I did find very, like, which is wonderful about the pandemic is, so the reading series, a lot of reading series went online for literature, and that was great because, you know, a lot of times if there's a reading in New York or San Francisco or something, we just don't see it in the Midwest. But a lot of those went online. So I feel like I got to experience a lot of, you know, like, really creative work that was happening that I wasn't doing, but I was still having that experience. And I think as a writer, artist, whatever, it kind of filters in, and sooner or later it's going to come out. It might not be a year or two, but, you know, dull periods, I think, happen to everybody.
Well, Bill, that's what that series, and I can't recall whether it was during COVID that I talked to you about before, about where you're evaluating or critiquing other poems. And that did that for me. I mean, it introduced me to so many new poets. I really enjoyed that. Was that a COVID time period where you did that?
I'm glad you found that. It was a series called First Reads I did on YouTube, which I'm still doing. And yeah, that was definitely a COVID thing. I felt like I just needed to have a conversation with contemporary poetry. So I looked for stuff that was being, you know, was in a journal within a year or two, and just literally went and did a first reading of it for my general impression. And it was fun. I didn't feel like I had to teach it or anything like that. So it's just a blast. I mean, I think sometimes as, you know, like an older artist, you forget the reason you got into it originally was that moment of, wow, that's really cool. And then you go and explain it and you kind of kill the coolness of it all. But that original thing is what got you there. So it was fun to just do that.
I was able to separate it. I really enjoyed the lesson of it and the way you saw it after you read it. I mean, I enjoyed the whole thing. Thank you for it.
You know, one thing I was going to ask both of you too, IUN is still a non-traditional, you have non-traditional students, many of them. You now have a lot more traditional students over the years, but tell us about the differences as far as your experience goes, teaching in that situation, teaching writing and the types of writing you do versus maybe a more traditional, you know, resident campus.
Well, I can jump in first. So I've been at IUN since 2000 in one capacity or the other. And actually, I've gotten job offers from other universities. I even taught briefly at Western Michigan. And I've always loved our students. And this is going to sound bad, but I mean it in the best possible way. They come in and they're not as idealistic as students are some other places. Like I also taught at some like fancy private schools, but they come in and they really want to work and they work really hard. They don't always have the best backgrounds, which is okay, but they really want to work. So when they get into something, they're really excited. Like I just taught Moby Dick in an American Lit class. And I had this one student who's like, I think I'm going to get a tattoo of Moby Dick. That was so incredible. It's just great to have those kind of experiences that sometimes, you know, at the nice private schools, I didn't see as much because they've been exposed to it a lot. And sometimes they didn't feel like they needed to put forth the effort. So I feel like a lot of times the poets especially are seeing things for the first time. It's just beautiful as a teacher to see somebody see something for the first time. It's a little different when they've written like 500 sonnets versus the very first time they write one. So I really enjoy that.
Yeah, I would compare a lot to my teaching at UIC where, you know, students just know certain things at IUN and that no one else knows, right? It's because of their work. It's because of the, because of the region as a cultural locus, that they know the world in a different way than the students I had in Chicago did. And so it's a real joy to kind of, when they start to kind of tap into that and start to put that on paper. We always, about two thirds of the way through the course, we shift into writing flash fictions in the fiction course. And so I'm always amazed what kinds of things they tap into that are local to them in those short fictions. A lot of those kinds of things reflect the region in its life.
So Garen, I don't know if you feel up to it, but I would really adore more readings from both of you if you feel up to it, like at your voice.
Yeah, sure. Would it be all right if I read a poem for another
Yes,
person?
Yes, please. Yeah, please. I think our audience would love to hear more writings.
So this is a page poem called Dale Berger Explains the Difference Between Fiction and Nonfiction as We Climb Mount Baldy Among the Indiana Dunes. And Dale is a friend of mine, a fiction writer, who's living up in Michigan now. Lydia Davis is back at South Bend detailing her fictive father's remains to get a glimpse of the grit we climbed Mount Baldy before sunset. Whole buildings are buried here, and a boy will in time be swallowed up by gaps in the dunes' hollow sands. Dale counts two cigarettes to the top. We climbed the slip face. From Notre Dame, we crossed an America that owned us in some vague way. Chicago across the lake, a dream in time. Between breaths and cigarettes, Dale says, is there a song in it? Fiction, I ask. No, he says, the lake, does it hold a sinister face? From the dune's crest, we study that lake, not some secondhand sea, but a thick northern river and its slow drain towards Erie, blown sand and retreating channels, deformable and windward. The Nipsco cooling tower and casino lights in Michigan City, it's hard not to think of Algren hustling home with a bucket of Schlitz and crossing the thin ice on his shortcut home to Miller. Elevation is a tough measure in Indiana. A wandering dune, Mount Baldy is no Hoosier Hill or the riverbank at Prophetstown. Black oaks poked from the sand, no one notices until a boy falls in. Dale's mind already turned north, his grandmother's cabin, wild turkeys in the North Michigan trees. Story accumulates where a surface exists already. From here, the lake seems mapless. Perhaps we are each rethinking which of us had been instructed to indulge the high, clear songs of the sirens of Luddington while the other packed his own ears with wax. What stories, what fictions? Against this place, stories are laid down like sand. the world a 4D game of Mumbly Peg played on a dead man's chest. There's an essential unstable element in this tendency, which is the fiction here. The Chicago towering on the lake's west edge, or the sage slipping beneath history's surface. The boy who disappears into the dune 13 years later, or his mother who says, I don't need a how and a why. Against the lake, this sand is no true wave, merely a crumpling of the surface. We descend the leeward slope, singing to the lake's perplexed machine, tuned to Ogren's drowning cry, and tacking the toll road northwest to home. Thanks.
Beautiful.
Magnificent.
Great images. Magnificent. Oh my gosh. You can feel that whole imagery. Well, Bill, we'll
have you done other area poems of, I mean, like so directly of this area?
I've been working on the last of the Illinois poems kind of crosses the border a little bit, and it's thinking about water and substance. Mm-hmm. And so Northwest Indiana plays heavily in that. And I've been working on a long nonfiction piece called The West Side of Gary, which is just kind of like focused on, you know, microgeographies and the ways in which things shift as you kind of cross over into Gary or out of Gary on the west side.
Ooh, I look forward to that.
You're listening to Art on the Air with William Allegrezza and Garen Seichel on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Well, Bill, if you'd share something else with us, we'd love to hear it.
All right. Well, I was going to do something local, but I didn't know that I can follow that. It was brilliant. I love seeing that one. So I'll do something that's not local at all, and it is very short and vague. I don't mean that in a bad way. It's meant to be that way. The dance. The water buffalo cried as we fought, and though I saw, I did not let go as I should, as we should. The water buffalo cried as we fought, the tears were a river through reeds, but I did not let go as I should, as we all should. Short little piece.
Wonderful. Which book is that from?
That one is from Stone and Type.
That's what I thought. I read that one. That's why. Yeah.
Yeah. Why don't I do one more? This one is hard to read in person. Whenever I get invited to do readings, I often tell people this one, I did a series of poems based on some poems by Pablo Neruda, and they're meant to be whispered in your ear, but it's really hard to do that in a big reading where you're screaming to be heard in the first place. So maybe this will work better in a radio setting, but this is meant to be whispered into someone's ear. It has no title. Between the story and the shore, the spider and the fire smoldering, I come with fugitive nets cast like dying seasons and flowers, crossed, loved, and then thrown among the seas fragments at dawn, always just a step behind catching you at the point where your body blends with air and we fade among the timid harbor reeds. I have said that to live we must be ravenous with doing, not be stuck with eyes locked on the burn, but now, overwhelmed, the silence has me in dream.
Very beautiful. So that makes me think of, how does your collaboration work when you're working on something together? Do you work on each other's pieces? Is it strictly individual? How do you work together, Bill?
We usually send things to each other and we shred them. And honestly, at the end of the work, half the time I'm like, did I write that? Did Garen write that? Who wrote that? I love that line. I usually just assume if it's a brilliant, beautiful line, I just assign it to Garen. I'm like, I couldn't do that, so it must be him. but we do shred each other's work a lot. I've done collaboratives with other writers. I'm actually working on a collaborative book with an Italian writer right now. And we do line by line and we don't touch each other's lines. So it's a very different experience with Garen. I feel like totally comfortable like shredding his stuff. And I feel like he can just change anything he wants and I'm going to be totally fine with it. I don't get offended or I don't get upset or try to add it back in or anything. And I love that aspect of it. Even when we've read before, I'm like reading through it, I'm like, I don't know where one line begins and ends with our voices at that point. So I think that's kind of cool to happen.
Yeah. I find that very beautiful. So Garen, have you collaborated with others before?
I would echo what Bill said too. That sense of working with him is our consciousnesses kind of have kind of an interesting kind of meshing that we kind of think through each other's ways of approaching the work and the places that we've been in. And it's hard to find with other people for me. I've done some fictional collaborations with Dale Berger, for whom that previous poem was written, and Mike Antonucci. And we always kind of had it laid out where we had a couple lines that we had to include within the fictions, and we'd each write a couple pages, and then you had to get to a certain line, and then the next person would take over. But we didn't edit each other heavily, and like as Bill said, we didn't shred each other's work, you know. And the thing you give up is you lose that nice sense of like, is that my line or is that, you know, my collaborator's line? And that's been one of the real joys of working with Bill.
Is there anything you both are looking forward to, projects you haven't worked on or, you know, got planned but haven't really started yet? Bill, we'll start with you.
So I have a plan. I'm taking a sabbatical in the fall, and I'm finishing three books of poetry, but I'm starting to work on a novel, so I'm very excited to work on that. I wrote one a few years ago, and I'm sitting on it. It's a very dark novel about people who commit suicide and other people's reaction to it. So I'm trying to figure out whether I want to rewrite it, but I'm very excited to switch and play around with fiction for a little bit. I've been sending out a bunch of short stories lately, and so it's a different thing completely. It feels like a totally different type of writing to me. So it's just enjoyable.
And Garen?
I've started a mystery set in Chicago about the disappearance of a university student and the detective who follows that. So that's kind of been where my energy's been lately. And then a few short fictional kind of pieces. And then nice poems that distract here and there. But the main project's been the long poem called Prairie, which is a kind of memory, autobiography of water in my memory, and kind of thinking through water as a substance and how that's played out in the different waters I remember from life.
Bill, you mentioned that when you look back at your old work, you go, oh, I want to change that. Do you find that with current work as well, or which book is the one that you would recommend that, you know, you wouldn't change anything?
So, you know, there's a couple that I would change a lot in. Like I said, Weaver's Valley, I would probably change a lot in. That's one of the ones I wrote, you know, in 50 days. My favorite one is from years ago. It's called Fragile Replacements. And it's the only book I've ever written where, like, the first section of it, I just wrote it in this weird state of being sucked in. Like, I come home from work and I would just write. And then when I put the last word together, it just felt like in my head something turned off and I couldn't touch it anymore. I couldn't edit anymore. And it's still by far my favorite book. It's called Fragile Replacements. It was put out by a San Francisco press years ago. But I kind of like look back and think, if I could write like that again, that would be awesome. I just got to get back to that. But I'm always interested in doing new stuff. So it's easy to criticize whatever you're doing. But that one's the only one I don't look back and say, I wish I could change it.
What I was going to ask both of you, I'm sure you come across students that say, well, I'd really like to be a writer. I know as a theater director, I came across that with my students wanting to go into acting or performing. What advice do you give them without breaking their spirit, but about the reality of making a living as a writer?
Become an accountant. He likes to write.
Well, I actually tell them what to do. Actually, Larry and Esther, I think you're doing, which is, I think, be part of the artistic community, make it live. You want to have a living, breathing community, do it. Be an actor in it and do it. I think that's part of living the life of it.
Yeah, I echo that for sure. Like, find your people and enjoy them, you know, and always be thankful for the, you know, for the readers who love your work and are willing to share within it.
Well, we just have a little over a minute left. We want to make sure that you have a chance to tell us where people can find your work. Also, maybe Facebook, other social media websites and things like that. So, Bill, tell us first.
Sure. Well, so I'm on Facebook and Instagram if you're interested. Also, you can always look me up at IUN. I'm there. I do have a website. It's allegrezza.info, I-N-F-O. And you can find all my books and links to them from there.
Garen?
I'm on Twitter at gpsycho1, on my website is the Surveillance, www.surveillancecity.com. rex.com. I post there once in a while. Rex is available through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and bookshop.org. In the city, I know that Pilsen Community Books is carrying it on the shelves. So
it's we should say Rex is not R-E-X, it's R-X.
R-X, yeah.
Well, we appreciate you guys coming on Art in the Air and sharing a little bit of your story, your background in writing. It's been very informative and everything, and our audience, I'm sure, will enjoy it. That's William Bill Allegrezza and Garen Seichel, both professors at IUN and great authors. Thank you so much for sharing your story, your life story on Art on the Air.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you all. It's been a joy.
You've been listening to Art in the Air, and we'd like to thank our guests this week on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art in the Air is heard every Friday at 11 a.m. and rebroadcast Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP. Art in the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks again to Greg Kovach, WVLP Station Manager, and Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio. Our theme music is by Billy Foster, with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant and the National Endowment for the Arts. Underwriters for Art in the Air, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments, and Mary LeVan, Arts Patron. Art in the Air is always looking for financial support. We'd like to thank our current supporters. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, Esther and I especially would invite you to become an underwriter of this program in particular. We have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA. You can find out support information there. So don't just be an Art on the Air listener. Become a supporter or underwriter in whatever amount you're able to do so we continue to bring you this great content and this great local programming. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. And you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.